Everybody, Stephen Cloutier back for another episode. I'm talking to Roger Barris today. He's an LP candidate running for the U.S. House of Representatives for 2nd District. He has quite the bio. He holds a BA in economics and an MBA in finance. He's an investor, entrepreneur, and he has his own company, which we can talk about. He's been a libertarian since he was 17, just like me. So I could honestly go on because his bio is so huge. But Roger, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Good. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess just tell us a little about yourself, anything I left out.
Oh, well, you know, as you say, I have been a libertarian since I was 17 years old. I remember I read David Friedman's The Machinery of Friedman. A friend of mine gave it to me in high school. And, you know, it's like when you have one of these magic moments when a light bulb clicks and you read a book and you kind of say, you know what, this is the truth. And, you know, up to then I'd been kind of like fashionably left wing. And then I read that book and I said, you know what, this is the way that we should be, this is the way that we should organize ourselves. And I've been a libertarian ever since then. So that was my epiphany when I was 17. I then went on, as you mentioned, I went on to get a degree in economics as an undergraduate at Bowdoin College, a college up in Maine. And then, of course, if you start off as a libertarian, and then if you study economics, you just become more and more libertarian.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know, economics is... you know, the overwhelming message of economics is that the way that we advance as a society, the way that we advance as individuals and people is through voluntary cooperation. And that's the beauty of our free market system, is that, you know, there's two ways you can try to organize society. You can try to organize society on a top-down basis, or you can rely upon the spontaneous order of the free market. And we all know that the top-down method never works. But conversely, the spontaneous order from a bottom-up spontaneous order is what has in fact brought us out of the Stone Ages and has created the world that we live in today, where we have unbelievable amounts of freedom, unbelievable amounts of security, and unbelievable amounts of material wealth. And all of that is the result of the economic system that you and I believe in.
I got to take it that when you were in school learning economics, they didn't talk about Austrian economics.
No, they didn't talk about Austrian economics. I actually did. First off, I wouldn't necessarily call myself an Austrian economist. I think that, you know, I'm kind of in the world of Milton Friedman, where he famously said, there's no Austrian economics, there's only good economics and bad economics. But I, and when I was learning as an undergraduate, I had the usual selection of Marxist professors. And I was actually the tutor for the department. So in my senior year. So these guys would go off, the freshmen would go off and they'd be taught their Marxist nonsense in class. And then they would come to my tutoring sessions, which were, you know, on Thursday nights, once a week. And I would say to them, no, everything you've learned is nonsense. This is the way the world works. And as a matter of fact, there's some guys I'm still in touch with whom I met and corrupted or influenced, shall I say, because they attended my tutoring sessions.
Wow, that is awesome. So, I mean, I guess you've seen a lot in your time. I guess one thing I want to talk about first is your business. Tell me about your business.
Yeah, so I went as an undergrad. I studied economics. I then went off and lived for a year in Japan, where I was teaching English and doing some other stuff. I actually got out of school a little early, so I was able to take some time off and go to Japan. Then I came back. I got an MBA in finance. And then I went off and worked in New York for a number of years, from 1985 to 1990. And when I was working in New York at that period of time, I was basically on the trading floor. But actually, one of my first jobs when I was working in New York was working in Exxon in their treasurer's office. And then I started to see really on firsthand how government regulations completely corrupt decisions that are made by businesses. And I always used to think to myself, it was how perverse it was that I could sit there in New York and just by shuffling papers and, you know, and some clever structuring with accountants and lawyers, I could produce much more value for the company than, you know, dozens of petroleum engineers back in Houston. And that's the system we've created. And obviously that is a completely perverted incentive that has an enormous impact on business.
I mean, this is a really good segue because you've worked for Goldman Sachs, you've worked for other banks. Yeah. Were you aware of the problems with things like fractional reserve banking and the Federal Reserve before you started working at these places? Or did working at Goldman Sachs kind of make you open your eyes?
Well, I would say, yeah. I mean, to quote you, so for example, I worked at Goldman in New York, and then I worked in, and then I quit working, lived in Japan, in France for a while, and then Goldman rehired me in London. And really what you started to see about 2005, 2006, 2007, and by then I was leading a group which was responsible for making investments of Goldman Sachs's own money, right? And Goldman Sachs and the subsequent firms that I worked for, their own money. And what you started to see was how corrupted the financial markets were by the Fed's policies at that point in time. The craziness of artificially low interest rates, the fact that it forced people, you know, the expression is TINA, there is no alternative. So it basically forced people to do very risky stuff that made very little economic sense, because that was the only way they could get any kind of reasonable yields. So for me, the original corrupting influence and the backdrop for the financial crisis in 2007 and 2008 was the fact that the Fed kept interest rates artificially low. You know, I always laugh when people say that the cause of the financial crisis was greed. I always say that that's like saying that, well, the reason the plane fell from the air is because of gravity. It means nothing. But, you know, there's always greed, just like there's always gravity. And so you have to ask yourself, why is it that sometimes greed overwhelms fear, which is the countervailing factor? And in that case, it's usually because the Fed has completely distorted the signals that the market needs by keeping interest rates artificially low. And when I did not lose money either personally or for my group or for my employer in the financial crisis. And the biggest reason for that is because with my Austrian sensibilities, I basically said, you know what? This world is crazy. It's going to blow up. I don't know how or when it's going to blow up, but I knew it was going to happen.
You know, Peter Schiff has been talking about this stuff for a long time, and he and me and like many others think that the next crash is really going to hurt. The 2008 crash was pretty bad, no doubt. But I mean, I think one of the problems related to the housing crash is just this fetish we have in getting people in homes that, right. You know, even if you're a single person, you definitely don't need a 5,000 square foot house. Let's get you in that house, even if you don't need it, even if you'd probably be fine in a one bedroom apartment. I forget the percentage. I think it's like 60% of the U.S. owns homes, something like that. But there's that fetish that, you know, we need to give people things they don't need. I was reading a Thomas Sowell book the other day, and he's talking about how I think in San Francisco, if you're in a family and you earn like $100,000, you're considered low income. So we subsidize this. Imagine you earn $100,000 a year and you're considered low income. $100,000 a year, most people could do great in most parts of the country.
look at you've put your finger on a number of things. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think that the most recent the tax plan put in place by the Trump administration was really in many respects a lost opportunity, but they did do some good things. And one of the good things they did was they started to cut back more on the incentives we have to home ownership through the deductibility of interest. You're absolutely right. We do have an absolute fetish. As you know, during the financial crisis, the worst offender in terms of promoting subprime loans was the government. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were the biggest promoters through both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I think at their peak, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were buying something like 75% of all the subprime mortgages that were being created. As you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were two of the biggest agencies or entities that needed to be bailed out during the financial crisis. And then the last thing, of course, is that through a whole bunch of government policies, they were basically forcing banks. They were basically going to banks and saying, look, if you guys want to merge or if you want to be given, you know, fair consideration in a whole bunch of other regulatory things, we want you to be shoving money out the door to people who, in many cases, were not appropriate borrowers. So the government was by far the largest entity behind the subprime crisis.
And one of the rebuttals opponents give is that they talk about the partial repeal of Glass-Steagall. Now, for people who don't know what Glass-Steagall is, from what I understand, it had two provisions. One is that you could not deal in securities, and the other is that you could institutions couldn't deal with other institutions that deal with securities. And I guess the partial repeal got rid of that last tenet. Maybe you could talk about that, because that's obviously one of the rebuttals because the thing is, that's the only source of deregulation they could point to at all, because obviously it's all based on overregulation.
You know, Steve, I just want everybody in the audience to know that you and I have not planned these questions, because this question is directly in my strike zone. This is one of my obsessions. But you're absolutely right. You know, when people talk about deregulation, and this is one of these lies that people keep on repeating and keep on repeating in the hope that it will finally be accepted as truth. Even the Washington Post, which is not exactly known as a bastion of free market capitalism, basically came out with an editorial a few years back kind of saying, hey, we have to stop saying this because there was no deregulation. Now, specifically, what they did with Glass-Steagall is that Glass-Steagall traditionally had a restriction that said that if you are a commercial, that you are a commercial bank and an investment bank could not be under common ownership. So they had to be separated, okay? That's the only thing they changed in Glass-Steagall was they said, okay, we will now allow commercial banks to own investment banks. But now ask yourself about all of the entities that, you know, that we think of when we think about the financial crisis. AIG, for example. AIG is an insurance company. It was completely unaffected by the change in Glass-Steagall. Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers was an investment bank. It was on one side of the Glass-Steagall wall at the beginning, and it always was on one side of the Glass-Steagall wall. It was completely unaffected by Glass-Steagall. Washington Mutual, which was a thrift in California that went belly up. Again, nothing to do with Glass-Steagall. Merrill Lynch, which probably would have gone belly up if it had not been bought by Bank of America. Again, nothing to do with Glass-Steagall. You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As a matter of fact, you could make a stronger argument that if Glass-Steagall had not been repealed, then the financial crisis would have been worse, because it would have been impossible for Bank of America to buy Merrill Lynch. And it would have been impossible for Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs to convert to bank holding companies and thereby get access to the Fed window, which means that on that fateful weekend in September when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, it probably would have been Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, and Morgan Stanley. And you can imagine the devastation of the financial system if that had happened. So, you know, this thing that Democrats keep on repeating is completely, what Democrats especially, I would say, is completely without foundation.
I think it's all plausible to them because they never actually go out and look for this stuff. So it's just, well, hold on, this has to be true. I heard my 10 other friends say it the other day. You know, another act they point to, let me pull it up here, it was the Commodity Futures of Modernization Act of 2000. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
Yeah, again, this is no, Commodity Futures Modernization Act has to deal with trading on the commodities market. So things like the CME, et cetera, in Chicago, these are futures markets, et cetera. Again, it has absolutely nothing to do with what happened in Glass-Steagall. The only thing that you could argue, or that happened in the financial crisis, the only thing that you could argue is that there was a lot of derivative trading. And as you know, there a lot of the problems in the financial crisis resulted from credit default swaps. Credit default swaps were never regulated in the commodity futures. The only thing you could potentially argue is that the government should have regulated them, but they never deregulated them because they never particularly regulated them. So again, this is another case. One of our political opponents love to just repeat stuff again and again and again. You know, one of my favorite myths in politics, as I always say, is the myth that, you know, we have a free market in healthcare and the failures of our healthcare system prove that a free market can't work. This is a total myth. We have nothing like a free market in healthcare. We've never had anything like a free market in healthcare. But these things just get repeated again and again. And as you point out, nobody actually ever looks at the foundation because it just becomes an accepted truth that they never question.
And even if they did look, they would just assume, oh, this must be not true, because I've heard, again, 10 other people say this one thing, and I'm just looking at this one source for the first time. You know, I don't know if you're aware of Dr. Mary Ruart. She's wonderful, but she has a new book titled Death by Regulation. I had her on, I forget which episode it was, but it's an amazing book because she talks about exactly what we're talking about, that our healthcare system nowadays is essentially based on how often you can get into the doctor for checkups. And it just inundates the system with all this nonsense versus actually promoting things like good medicine. And one thing she points out is that there's kind of this idea that we should be against medicine. Well, not exactly. The way the FDA works right now, they make it very, very expensive to create drugs. Why is EpiPen so expensive? Well, because of patent laws and, you know, you have a monopoly on production. What do you think about all that?
Well, you know, look, first off, I know Dr. Mary Ruart, and she was obviously a Libertarian Party candidate a number of years ago. But, you know, she's absolutely right. And this is something I've written about extensively. My training is in economics, but I have a particular interest in this area. First off, it's very important. But you're absolutely right. As I always say, look, you know, at the end of the day, the problem with U.S. healthcare is price. Why is it so incredibly expensive and incredibly unpredictable, right? And what economics teaches us is that price is the intersection between two things, supply and demand. And the reality is that the government has been distorting both supply and demand for years. You know, on the demand side, the fundamental problem is that 85 to 95% of our healthcare costs are covered by somebody else, right? And I always say to people, you know, if your dinner was being paid, 89 to 95% of your dinner was being paid tonight, guess what? You know, you would be eating steak every night and there would be no prices on the menu. Right? So that's exactly what we've done on the demand side. And we've distorted it because, as you know, there are huge tax benefits to compensating people through over-insurance.
And the things that occur in this healthcare system, it almost sounds unbelievable. I had a friend who was at a hospital recently, and literally this is what happened. He was talking to the doctor, and he was making a joke saying, like, oh, you know, I need a cigarette right now. He doesn't smoke cigarettes. That's the point. So right. the doctor said to him, oh, you should quit smoking, by the way. And the guy again says, hey, I was just making a joke. I don't smoke. He looks at his bill when he receives it like a week or two later, and there's a little charge there. It says smoking cessation session, less than 5 minutes. So some of this stuff sounds unbelievable.
No, but you're right. But we have, you know, we have exactly the distortion that we would expect. And, you know, and actually, as you remember, Gary Johnson back in 2016 used to run around and he was right. He would say that, look, you know, we have, there's an example of part of healthcare which functions the way the rest of the market functions. This is laser eye surgery. Okay. And the reason it functions is because the people who consume are the people who pay. All right. Which means that when you go into a laser eye, you know, go in for laser eye surgery, first off, the price has done nothing but fall for the last 30 to 40 years. So when you hear all these people say, yeah, the reason medicine's so expensive is because of all this technology. No, technology makes things better and cheaper. It doesn't make them more expensive. Okay. And that's exactly what it's done in laser eye surgery. And likewise, you walk in for laser eye surgery and you know exactly what you're going to pay. And that's what a free market in healthcare would produce. And we have the last thing in the world from that. There's distortions, massive distortions on both sides. As you point out, FDA, you know, we should be, generics should be much easier to get at than they are. It should be easy to import drugs from abroad. All of these things are crony capitalism, favors to the pharmaceutical companies that the government has imposed. This is not the free market.
I think a lot of libertarians fall into the trap of thinking that insurance itself is bad. Well, no, insurance definitely has a place in a free market. But I was watching this one doctor on John Stossel one time, and he's talking about how once he got insurance companies out of the way and started providing direct care, direct from doctor to patient care, his costs just plummeted. His overhead just plummeted. Sure. I guess that's another thing. The way insurance is now embedded in the system, it definitely screws everything up.
Yeah, but again, insurance, as I always say, is that, look, I have insurance for my automobile, which means that if I crash my automobile and destroy it, someone pays it. But my insurance doesn't pay for routine oil changes and worn tires, okay? The insurance, real insurance, by definition, is always catastrophic, right? People should be insured, of course, but they should be insured for some type of catastrophic event. They should not be insured for the routine expenditures that you incur, like everybody incurs. Just like I have to buy food, I have to go for routine medical care.
I think the correct analogy, you know, related to Obamacare is, you know, you have a car, you want to buy car insurance, but you're forced to buy truck insurance, boat insurance, like all these different types of insurance at once, right. But you really just need the car insurance.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But, you know, and when you bring up Obamacare, and this is another big theme, and this is something you look like you're a young pup. So
I just turned 26. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. So this is something I always tell young people when I'm talking to them. I say, look, guys, you don't understand the system. You know, the system by definition is skewed against you because the government always favors the status quo against the future. And guess what? You are the future. Okay. So in so many ways, the government is detrimental to young people. You know, the national debt, you know, the entitlement programs, you know, et cetera. But and likewise, Obamacare, the entire economics of Obamacare was built upon the idea that I am going to force young, healthy people to pay too much for their insurance to cross-subsidize old, sick people. The world, and this, it also is an environment where older people are actually much wealthier than young people.
And Roger, the way I've always thought about it, if you're a poor person and you have a $5,000 deductible and you have no money in the bank, for all intents and purposes, you're uninsured.
Yeah, that is definitely true. And ironically, then this is, the people who support Obamacare think that, that one of the benefits of Obamacare is that it's actually turning down the curve of cost escalation. The reason it may be doing that is only ironic because basically the response to Obamacare has been to lift deductibles so that people are now getting the type of catastrophic insurance that they should have had from the beginning. But what people don't understand, they complain, they say, don't take away my Obamacare. What am I going to do then? What they don't understand is that they are paying for this cost anyway. They're paying it either in the form of higher taxes, or they're paying it in salaries, which are artificially low because their employer has to pay very high insurance rates, et cetera. So this cost is already being borne by people. It's just being borne in a way that they don't realize and which gives them very poor incentives.
And I guess the obvious point is in any area where there's a market for things, it doesn't need to be subsidized. We don't need to subsidize cell phones because if every single cell phone was $1,000, no one would use cell phones. I mean, I can go down to Walmart right now, get a $20 prepaid phone, and I'll be on the phone. I'll be on the internet. I'll be live on the internet. Yep. There's a market for pens. There's a market for everything. But when it comes to healthcare, people look at the government essentially mandated price or artificially set price, and they think, wow, like the market sucks.
No, we've all had this experience. Nine times out of 10, the free market is blamed for a problem created by the government. And then usually nine times out of 10, what people propose is as a fix for it is more government. This is how we ended up with the Leviathan that we currently have, is that the government, and this is, as is part of the analysis of someone like Mises, whenever the government starts to intrude on the market, it causes problems, and then it usually generates a call for more government. And it's that dynamic that we need to reverse.
Yeah, exactly. I think Milton Friedman said once that when a private business fails, they just go under, they just fail.
Right.
When the government messes up, it's guaranteed to be expanded, whatever they do. This has been a really, really enlightening conversation, Roger. I mean, I could talk to you for probably hours and hours, but I want to wrap up with this question. You've lived all over Europe. You've lived in places such as England, France, and Switzerland. And Switzerland in particular is widely misunderstood. Can you talk about your experiences there, please?
Yeah, sure. As a matter of fact, I think that is, first off, I was living in a place called Zug. And Zug is one of the more tax-advantaged parts of Switzerland. And, the basic message that I take back from my European travels was that, we are now at the point where we can go in the direction of Switzerland, in the direction of small government, in the direction of non-interference in foreign affairs, in the direction of, minimal regulation, in the direction of, and I'll come back to this point, in the direction of having decisions made at the lowest level of government possible, or we can go in the direction of France. And I know which of those two I prefer. And a big part of the lesson I take back from Switzerland, and this is also a big part of my campaign, is that we have to push government decisions to the extent that we need government at all. We need it at the lowest level possible, right? So that, because this allows a couple of things. Number one, and this was very much my experience in Switzerland, it forces governments to compete because competition is the most important thing that we need in our economy. That's true of the private sector, but it's also true of the public sector. This is a big reason why, for example, I'm in favor of school choice. We need competition. Monopoly is a bad thing no matter where it happens in government or in the private sector. So if we push decisions down to the lowest level possible, you can force governments to compete. And we see that happening now with the stream of people leaving California and going to a place like Texas. That's number one. We force them to compete. Number two is that we have, that creates the opportunity for, in the worst case, for people to vote with their feet and move with their feet. Number three, it allows all of the states to be, you know, to be laboratories of experimentation, so that we can look at different states, see what works the best, and then choose that, and then adapt that in other parts. So that is a big theme that I learned when I was in Switzerland. We must force government to compete, and the way we force them to compete is that we push decisions to the lowest level possible.
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest problem with government on principle is that they tend to lack the incentives to do things like people do when they actually have things on the line. If I have a lot to lose by, you know, starting a business, I'm damn well going to make sure I get up at 5 a.m., do everything I have to do. But if I know for a fact that I don't really have to work that hard, I can miss my bills, I'm going to get subsidized, well, that's exactly what's going to happen, is I'm going to care that much less. So I totally agree with everything you're saying. Well, Roger, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Let's do this again soon. Where can we find you?
Okay, so if people want to know about my campaign, the best place to look is www.barris4, that is the number 4, Barris, which is B-A-R-R-I-S, 4congress.com. And that has a very elaborate discussion. I think I talk about 20 different issues. You know, like most libertarians, I'm a policy geek. So I will.
You have one of the best campaign sites I've seen. Not to put down other libertarians, but you know, some of them could use the market to their advantage to set up a better website. But your website, I was reading through it for like 15 minutes. Like, your bio is huge. You're talking about all the issues. It's great. I really hope you do well, Roger.
Well, there. Hey, listen, Steve. It certainly helps for, you know, opportunities to talk to other libertarians like this. And please, I'm on that. I'm also on social media. I'm on Facebook, also at Barris for Congress. You can follow me on Twitter. Please follow me, like me, retweet. Let's create a snowball effect, because I think we can win this thing.
That sounds great. I totally agree, Roger. Well, thanks a bunch, and we'll see you next time.
Take care. Thanks. Bye-bye.